Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This September series of podcasts is sponsored by Sweetwater, who, for the month of September, are rolling out incredible exclusives. Like Fender Custom Shop GT11 Strats and Tellys and the Walrus Deep 6 Voyager Combo Pedal, plus major deals on coveted gear like the Wayhuge Javelina Fuzz at a super low price while supplies last. And that's not all. September is Guitar Month, and it's absolutely packed with mind-blowing giveaways, 48-month interest-free financing on many great brands, and plenty of price drops, instant rebates, and limited-time offers that you won't want to miss out on. Did I mention that Sweetwater is now a Guinness World Record title holder? To find out more, go to sweetwater.com, stop by their YouTube, or listen to the rest of this podcast series. Hello and welcome to the Friday Special Podcast Series, a podcast series by Guitar Nerds hosted by me, Joe Branton, and the resident Guitar Nerds pedal expert, Matt Knight.
Hello.
Every week on this podcast series, we're going to include a guest from the world of effects, and this week we're lucky enough to have Thorpey from Thorpey Effects here with us on the show.
Hello, how you doing?
Hello, yes, we're all good. Now, in this podcast series, Matt and I wanted to talk to those boutique manufacturers that I guess we feel have had a substantial impact on people's rigs, how they use them, and those people who have created things that are, while still boutique, are appearing on boards, you know, alongside Boss, Strymon, TC, etc., the world over, and, you know, on pretty much every Instagram post you can see. And that obviously includes Thorpey Effects. So it's great to actually get to talk to you. It's the first time we've ever had you on a Guitar Nerds episode, and it's something that we're trying to do a load more, basically because me and Matt have got really bored with Mark and Jay, so we're just trying to do this separate series where we actually get to talk about equipment. I mean, literally, Jay just owns a Watkins Copycat, and I'm pretty sure Mark just owns a Boss TU2 tuner. It's nice to talk about effects.
It's nice to talk a little bit more in depth, I guess, about gear. Well, I mean, we do talk in depth about gear, and, you know, as Joe said, I am in the podcast the resident pedal expert, but when people like yourself are on it, I'm a bit like, yeah, well, I don't really build them, so I can comment on capacitors and tone.
That's all you need. Don't worry.
All you need. Just make it up.
Yeah, exactly.
NOS, true bypass, you know.
Well, I mean, to I guess kick it off, and for listener, if you're not aware of Thorpey Effects are actually relatively new in comparison to, you know, the most effects brands, I think, that are on people's lips as much as Thorpey Effects are, because you've been making pedals since 2014, which is not an especially long time.
Yeah, the brand launched November 2014, and we released our first product April the 1st, 2015, just to make it fun, you know.
what was the first pedal in the Thorpey lineup?
So the first pedal was the Gunshot Overdrive, and I've been working on it for a little while. So I'd been building pedals for, blimey, bloody hell, since year 2000.
Really?
Around that 2002, actually. And
what took you 14 years to decide to make it into a thing?
Well, that's a well, I had a proper career beforehand. I don't mean to say that building pedals isn't a proper career. but I worked for Her Majesty's government, and I was very, very busy. And I was going down the career path of, you know, training up as a bomb disposal officer, explosives expert, blah, blah, blah. And
just as you do.
Yeah. And I was doing this as a hobby, a part-time thing, just to relax, weirdly. And so it took me 14 years because actually I was going to launch the company in 2008, but I was going through some marriage difficulties with my previous Mrs. Thorpe, and I decided against it.
Right.
Sorry, that's far too much information. Yeah. There.
At least you said it and we didn't drop that one in. So I hear there were some problems at home.
Well, listeners, welcome to the new counselling sessions provided by Guitar Nerds.
Do you know what? If you speak to any military person, they'll be rare if they don't have marriage problems. You're away so much, it's just one of those things.
Sure,
you
know? Sure.
And I guess we should also point out you're actually an MBE, right?
I am, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. So there you go. What an honour. And you build pedals. You've got to be the first pedal builder with that, I'm sure.
I don't know. Maybe Jim Marshall. But
Yeah,
maybe Jim Marshall, I think. I'm not sure. Is it Clive Orange? I'm not sure what he's... Yeah. But
I'll ask him.
You know, Jim didn't actually build the pedals himself, though. So, yeah, maybe.
So you got one up on him. That's all right.
Yeah, great. Yeah, you screw you and your multinational company. I'm doing all right.
So the first thing you put out, so in 2014, the first thing you put out was a drive.
Yeah.
And kind of, I guess drives and fuzzes have been something that have dominated your lineup since then as well.
Yeah, I'd say that's fair. I mean, you've got to bear in mind that when you do these things, a lot of the time you do things that you're passionate about. Now, I absolutely love analog effects, and I particularly like fuzzers, and I particularly like drives and boosts and things like that. Where things are changing up now is we are trying to expand our modulation line. So I've released a chorus and we're working on a flanger. And,
well, okay, so yeah, the deep organ is the chorus vibrato that you put out.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
There's not another one, is there? There's not another chorus?
No, that's it. And then we've got a flanger in the works.
Oh, that's exciting.
Well, it's done.
Right. It's worked.
It's done. It's ready. And I'm in the process, you know how things go, Matt. I'm in the process of getting down that path to launch.
That was the sort of question that sort of I had, obviously. So you'd launched the company officially in 2014 and you'd been working on it for a while. The one thing I want to know is how, obviously, you're the man in front of the whole company, so your whole heart and passion goes into all the projects. How long did it take you to come up with the chassis design? Because obviously that's the unit. I think there's so many pedals out there and so many great pedals and so many great builders. And there's obviously people have capitalized on that and said, well, we make enclosures and we'll print enclosures and we'll print your circuit boards and all this sort of thing. And you're still so much hands-on. Well, and actually you've gone down the route of building your own chassis.
This is the ultimate question. This is early to bring in this question, because really that is the thing, isn't it? For Thorpe FX, it's just that these chassis are so far away from the beaten track of, you know, because there are a lot of boutique effects companies at the moment, and some of them are coming up with, you know, amazing looking graphics that are really kind of giving them their own identity. But I don't think there's anything out there that's done it quite as much as a Thorpe FX. And, you know, I kind of said it in the intro to this podcast, that's sort of what we're talking about, those pedals that you notice when they are on a board, and you always notice a Thorpe FX pedal when they're on a board. So yeah, I guess, you know,
I can probably elaborate on this. So I would say that actually Boss were one of those companies that I wanted to emulate in this regard, and I'm quite happy to say that, because Boss did their own thing and they did it very early on in the 1970s, you know, when they moved from the C1 to the C2 and all that sort of stuff, and the SD1 and Anyway, that stands a Boss pedal apart. You can look at any pedal board, you go, yeah, that's a Boss. You don't even need to know what it is. You go, yeah, that's a Boss. And so for me, I could do the whole Me Too thing and go, you know, this is, mine's the same as everyone else's. Well, why is yours different? Well, because it sounds different. Yeah, but, you know, ultimately, that's a given as far as I'm concerned. So what I wanted to do is, I'm an engineer. I wanted to not only look different, the look different is a consequence of trying to engineer things differently. And some of the things that I like were like with Boss, you can't tread on the knobs on a Boss pedal. I also want...
I was going to bring that up. I was going, because that's one of the things when you talk about engineering, the fact that you've recessed the controls in the same way that a Boss pedal does. And that's one of the most unique things about Boss that's strange that so few other companies have adopted.
Because it's hard. The problem right. is it costs more. All of that, if it's difficult, and especially you've got to understand with a lot of companies in the boutique world, and ours notwithstanding, you know, it's the same for us, to do that costs money. It just does. And when you start off, that is money you don't want to spend necessarily. You'd rather spend the money on the internals and all the rest of it.
Of course.
But I thought it was so vital to do that, that I found the money and just paid for it. And it wasn't insubstantial. You know, it costs a lot of money to do that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So there are two, is it two or are there three different chassis sizes?
Well, initially we had two, and then I reinvested last year and shrunk them a bit.
Right.
Because just to go with what the market wanted. I think, like, I don't want to do mini pedals because I'm an 18 stone bloke and I'm just going to kick them over and smash them up.
Oh, Matt, Matt hates a mini pedal.
I hate a mini pedal. Your foot's the same size. Your foot's not mini.
I'm going to go on a rant here. I'll tell you why I hate mini pedals. Aside from my size 11 feet, okay, and my stupid body weight, regardless of that, because of the size of them, the jacks have to go on the side. And guess what? When you put the jacks on the side, they take up virtually the same amount of space as a normal pedal with top mounted jacks like ours. So what's the point? Just have something that sits stable, doesn't float around. Otherwise, just stick it in your pocket and be done with it.
Maybe that's the future. Maybe we're all missing the trick here.
Oh, there we go. We'll trademark that. Pocket pedals.
Pocket pedals.
By Guitar Nerds and Thorpe Effects. There you go.
But I think what's really interesting is you obviously made a conscious decision right at the beginning to go, that's what I'm going to do. I mean, I remember sending you a message quite maybe a year or so ago where I saw one of your old, you know, just a copy circuit, clone circuit you'd obviously built and just put a name on it on eBay about a year ago. And obviously that's when you were just making pedals way before Thorpe kind of even existed.
Yeah.
And I think that's the great thing is that, like you say, like a Boss pedal or you know, other unique designs, you know, it's the Thorpe pedal as soon as you see it, and it helps stand out. And that's like a strong marketing presence that you can't like you say, if you're on a pedal board with a bunch of other pedals that all look the same, how do you stand out? But instantly, people are drawn to your products, and then that makes them want to plug it in. I think it's just a genius move that to kind of really, like you say, invest that money.
So to be honest with you, I did all that work because I knew I had to stand out, right? Fact, one way or the other. And I don't know if you're aware, I used to live right near Dan Steinhardt of that pedal show, okay? And we lived in Swindon, both of us. I've moved away from Swindon now, but I used to build effects for him occasionally. Like, he had a need for, say, a fuzz or something like that. And I'd build it in a standard sort of Hammond box. I told him that I was planning to launch my own company. And I was thinking of doing this. And I was thinking of doing it a little bit more individual. But I wasn't sure about whether the money was worth investing. And actually, he was the one who, I would suggest, gave me that push over the edge. He was
really?
Yeah, absolutely. Because sometimes you need... You need a little bit of assurance from someone, say, actually, you are on the right track. Actually, you should do it this way. And he was that guy because he was very helpful in just, I don't know, he just pointed me in the right direction of research and said, right, go and have a look and see how many effects pedals there are and see how many look different. And it was at the time, it was probably, I could count a couple of brands on you know, my fingers. That's it. And that was it for me. So I just then, from that point on, I was like, yeah, good. And he was the first person who saw what I designed.
That's great. Oh, what a great person to have as a sounding board as well. Like, you know, what an important cornerstone of the sort of gear community to get to live near and get to use as a
total fluke. Total fluke that we live near him. But yeah. He's a bit of a legend, and
absolutely.
He's got, I tell you, he has absolute golden ears. And, you know, he has told me in the past when I've showed him something, he's gone, yeah, that needs fixing, this. And do you know what? That's so important, because if you don't have that, you're just going to release it because you think it's great.
Yeah.
And no one thinks their kids are ugly. It takes someone else telling you that your kids are bloody ugly.
It's funny, actually, because I sort of had a similar question for Brian Wampler, in the fact that it must be difficult when you're designing pedals to kind of maybe have to, you come to a crossroads where you're like, I would do it this way because that's how I want the pedal to sound, but no one but me will buy it.
Yep, commercial suicide.
Or I can go the other way, and I can actually build a product that everyone's going to want, but it might not necessarily be a pedal that I would maybe personally use, or a sound that I.
Well, yeah, let's lead into that then. When you're breadboarding, then this is normally your question, Matt, on these podcasts. But when you're breadboarding, have you ever sort of been forced into making a decision for the greater good, as in, you know, making something that isn't necessarily 100% what you want, but you think will make the pedal maybe more, you know, utilitarian, so everyone can use it a bit better. Have you ever backed out of something?
Every time.
Really?
Literally every time. I'll tell you why. So my specialism, and in a previous career, was I would suppose you'd describe it as being involved with weapons development and procurement. Okay. Now, that doesn't make me evil. It was just part of the job. Okay.
Sure.
You might think it makes me evil, but anyway, part of that was trying to get kit and equipment into the hands of soldiers who were going to be under stress. Okay. And they were going to design, you design this product so that when they're under stress, they can use the equipment and use it without even thinking about it. So you don't put unnecessary handles on it. You don't put stuff on it that's going to stab them in the face as soon as they, hit some sort of explosion or whatever. And you don't make the thing super complex, because a human being under stress goes to pot. That's just the way it is.
Right.
And so you need it to be intuitive. Now, with regards to my pedals, I just took the same approach, take the same approach.
That is incredible. Like, just the fact that you must be the only pedal manufacturer who is taking these, and what you're talking about there could kind of be applied to anything, even outside of weapons as well. What you're talking about is thinking about things from an incredibly pragmatic perspective, and you've been able to introduce that into the pedal world.
Yeah, because I mean, my trade as a bomb disposal officer is naturally stressful. It doesn't matter what you're doing. It doesn't matter whether you're under fire. You've got something down the road that can kill you, right? Sure. And that's just the way it is. So what you have to do is unpick all of that. You roll back. You try and remove that stress as much as you can. And everything that you have should work. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, being a guitarist is the same as defusing a bomb or anything like that. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is, being on stage, whether it's your first time, your 20,000th time, is really stressful, and you've got enough to think about. You don't need 6,000 switches, 20,000 things to go wrong. What you need is something that when you turn it, it's so intuitive, it's done.
Absolutely.
That's my approach to things. Now, other people adopt a different approach, and that's equally as valid, but I prefer to do it this way, just because of experience.
I guess, hence your very, very analog approach to everything, and I guess, you know, avoidance of anything digital.
Sort of. I mean, I'll have to be, you know, I'll be honest with you. I don't have the digital skill set. I don't have what Joel Court has. I don't have that knowledge yet.
Sure. Well, I think it's one interesting thing that you mentioned, you know, Joel from Chase Bliss, is actually, you know, recently, he came out and said, you know, look, we're working on this looper and we basically don't have someone who's got this particular set of knowledge and we need someone and we'll pay them to do it. And actually, I think it happens a lot. I was talking to, someone at NAMM and they were like, oh yeah, I got X to do it. And I think a lot of people actually consult Robert Keeley because he's like, you know, he really knows DSP. And I think unless you've sat
his son particularly.
It's not an easy thing to get. I mean, I've seen people code in our head office and gone, I no idea what.
It's like the Matrix. Yeah, you're like, oh, brilliant. Where's Keanu Reeves? but no, I think do you know what? There is a saying I heard it yesterday actually as well. It goes along the line. What's the difference between genius and stupidity? Well, a genius knows their limits, and a stupid person doesn't know that they're stupid. And so, you know, what you've got to do is you've got to park the ego for 1 second and actually just go, you know what? I can get someone who's a subject matter expert on this. Now, I personally, I'm not a subject matter expert on anything regarding DSP. Just am not. So when I move into that field, which we will, I will make sure I hire someone who's absolutely a subject matter expert in that field.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to talk about, you know, future expansions in the range and stuff. But yeah. Before we leave like the topic of, you know, talking about how unique the chassis were, and I'm really glad there was a really strong sort of story behind that, and how much that was such a consideration for you to make the Thorpe FX pedal stand out physically as much as everything else. But it's not just that that gives Thorpe FX their uniqueness; it's also the names. Now, obviously, we've spoken about your history and job background already, but you've named everything with a very, very specific theme.
Yeah. I mean, there is an argument to say go with what you know. You know, when you spend 20 years in a field, guess what? You're going to be influenced by it. And the great thing about that is, like you've already said, it's a little bit niche. It's a little bit weird. And consequently, the likelihood of someone in the pedal world having had the same experiences as me and able to draw those names makes my life so much easier, because I can name something and not worry about it, because another pedal company just isn't going to go down that route.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. And you get a lot of repeat names, and you know, everyone's trying to think of the next play on words to sort of say Clon without saying Clon, you know.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Cylon. Yeah. There we go. Yeah. Spacey Clon, that is.
Yeah, great.
Someone's gonna do that.
So this is, I guess, sort of leading into talking about sort of the future expansion of your range. And I guess this is an incredibly obvious question and probably one that you can't answer. But I'd be interested to know if you have a favorite thing that you've made in your lineup, like something that had an especial spark that when you finished you were, and I'm sure it's the case with every pedal, but was there something that really just really was everything you ever wanted to make?
Yeah. Okay. So current lineup, I've got to say that's the Fallout Cloud for me. Because I was trying to, at the outset, basically nail a particular tone from a particular type of Big Muff, right?
Right.
They're all Goldilocks pedals. Too much of this, too little of that. And they're amazing. And the original designer, hats off to him. But to try and clone something is not my thing. I just don't want to do it. I will try and do something different. Anyway, so what I wanted to do is get the sonic footprint right. And the Fallout Cloud, or as it was, the Muffroom Cloud, sought to emulate that particular pedal, that particular sound, and then add and take away from that so that there was a load more. Now, the thing is with that pedal, when I plugged it in, gave me goosebumps, which is so lame, but it really did, because I plugged it in, strummed an open E, and that's it. You're like, whoa.
Yeah.
And you know, I implore anyone to go and give it a go. You know, just try it, because it's hilarious, and the smiles I see on people's faces is just amazing.
Is there anything that you, I mean, maybe you can, maybe you can't answer this, but is there anything that you're sort of, you're working on circuit-wise, or you've worked on, and you've just had to park it because you're like, I'm just not, you can't quite finish it. It's like, it's what they say, like red light syndrome, you know, when you're in a recording studio. Is there one that you're just like, you keep going back to and it's still just not right?
Yeah, but I got it done this year and it's not rare. I can't say why, but right. It's done. It took 4 years.
Oh.
Right? I'm surprised I'm not bold, but I'm happy. I'm over the moon.
Great.
Oh, well, nice.
Yeah. I mean, if you take 4 years to make something, yeah, I really hope that you are really happy with the end.
It was hard work. I nearly, you know, I was like, oh no, is it ever going to end?
And is there any sort of, I mean, again, the great thing about you and the times that we've talked about you on the pedal, obviously you've got things like the Fallout Cloud, which like you say is...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
It's kind of like your favorite Big Muff, but nothing stands out instantly as like, this is a homage to this. Everything seems like your own design. But is there a circuit that you would like to attempt? Like something you'd like to go, I kind of like to have something that's a bit like this? Or do you really just want to kind of start from a blank canvas and just build up from that?
Do you know what? One of the things that's very, very difficult in the guitar gear world is trying to sell something that doesn't have a touchstone. So if I made a new overdrive, or in fact, sorry, we'll go a different route. Say I made a phaser and I didn't tell people that it could emulate ye olde ancient phaser from ye olde land.
Oh, this is a fantastic point.
I would not be able to sell the thing. It would be really hard. So unless it was one of the most crazy noisemakers that was ever thing, and then someone like, I don't know, a very famous guitarist, John Mayer, say, just started to use it on a song, and that became that song. It's a very hard sell to traditional guitarists.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were absolutely right. And as soon as you're in that analog world, as soon as you're aiming at these sort of standard range of effects, like, you know, nothing that you're making is trying to be something like the Mataverse Air Trash, for example, you know, which is just supposed to be, you know, weird, crazy noise that no one other than sort of Nick Reinhardt and Terry Melis would be able to make sound of. As soon as you're trying to make something that is essentially traditional, I guess the effect thing, I've never thought about it, but I guess effects pedals suffer from the same thing that the guitar world does, in that, you know, if you make a traditional guitar, if you want to make a traditional guitar, you better make it look like a Telecaster or a Jazzmaster or something, because otherwise, you know, people aren't going to be interested.
Yeah, I mean, the way to do it is what we're trying to do, which is go, okay, so the Depog in chorus, I know what choruses I really like. I like the Electro-Harmonix Small Clone. I think it's a Small Clone, yeah.
Yeah.
And then it's the Boss CE1, the Boss CE2, and then the Roland Jazz Chorus. So these are all chorus sounds that I really enjoy. And they're on classic records, and they're amazing, okay? I also like things which are a lot more syrupy. And so what I did when I set out is go, okay, well, they're my touchstones. That's what I want to be able to hit sonically. And how can I make a pedal that can do that and do a lot more? And so that's where the depogging, you know, particularly came from. It went, I want to hit those sonic footprints, and now I want more because I'm greedy. and I do that with every pedal. So anything that I want to be able to cover off a little bit of ground. And it might only cover that ground in a very specific setting. But over and above that, it needs to do loads more.
Yeah. So speaking of the depogging, I was thinking about this the other day. Is it just that there's so much going on in the circuitry that you had to put it in the larger chassis?
Mate, that pedal is rammed to the gunnels and there's no battery in there. It's ridiculous.
Because I was looking at it and I was like, but it's the same amount of controls that you can fit on your smaller size on the drives. And I was like, no, I guess it must be completely rammed. Because I think it's the only double pedal with like a single... with just one foot switch,
and it's off to the side, which has annoyed everyone.
Yeah,
of course it has. I mean, part of that was I wanted the artwork to sit where it did, and part of it was because that if I moved the foot switch, and then I had to be really careful with the wiring because the way that the circuit board was laid out, if you run the input and the output near the clock, you end up with a ticking noise that comes through. Loads of chorus.
Really?
Loads of choruses are afflicted by it.
I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Yeah. So what you have to do is you have to keep the inputs and the outputs away from the clock within the circuit. And if you do that, guess what? Things are quiet. Or you can do it in the, you know, lazy way, which is to shield the output and all the rest of it. But you'll still hear it when you've got gain running into it.
Right.
And the depogging was designed so that it works with gain. And so because I want the gain to be run into the depogging, I can't have clock noise on the pedal because it will just go. And that is rubbish.
Yeah. I appreciate, Matt, you probably knew that, but you know, from a layman's perspective, that's such a ridiculous thing to have to consider.
I think what's great as well is hearing those stories from you about building pedals. The stories that I've kind of learned from working at Boss, and they're the cool little things that when that information gets out there through telling people at shows or people listening to this podcast, I think that's just a really nice story that adds a touch more character to your product, and it feels way more human, I think, at that point as well.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like someone's just gone, oh, well, I've dragged a C1 circuit diagram off wherever, and I've just built that, and I've put it in my own box sort of thing. It feels like you've, you know, there's all that thought and human touch to it. And I guess what's interesting with that pedal as well is you also collaborated with Dan Coggins of Love Tone.
Yeah.
Like the original boutique pedal people, I guess, in some way.
Correct. And that man is an absolute genius. You know, when I sit down and work on something that can take me a month, he can do it, and I'm not even exaggerating, 10 minutes. It blows my mind how cool. Like, it's just and he's this encyclopedic knowledge, really. He is a bit of a legend. And you know, and that saying that, the depogging still took us ages to get right.
Really?
Yeah, despite all of that, we were very critical of what we wanted there. And neither of us wanted to go, oh, this is a straight up clone. We're just not that way inclined, either of us. So if you're going to do something and put the effort in, do it properly and try and improve the game. Now, in the analog realm, that's quite hard because in theory, we've got decades of experience in this. So how do you improve it? Well, we thought we did, and then it wasn't good enough. So we carried on. And in the end, we had to freeze the design because we got to the point where we were picking the tiniest criticisms. And ultimately, that's when you pull out the OGs, the ones that your touchstones were, and you compare them to them. And you go, how have I improved over that? And then the product's done. That's how we do it anyway.
Mm. Amazing. That's...
And I think one product that really shows that as well, in a way, and against almost your own product, and I know it was something personally I hounded you about, was the Heavy Water, which is obviously taking the boost side of the Dane, and you haven't just put that in a standalone box. And I thought that was, when I saw that, I was like, that's just brilliant. I'm so glad you did that, because it would have been so easy for you to just go, oh, I'll just stick the boost in a chassis. We already make those and we already do the circuit. And I think you've, yeah, really improved upon what was already a great boost.
Well, the answer is live by the sword, die by the sword. I can't turn around and say, oh, I want to improve on anything. Oh, but if it's my product, well, I'll just leave it because I'm a lazy ass. life isn't like that. You've got to go for it. And I think part of that was down to the fact that actually, having gone through the prototyping stage, and it went through a number of iterations, the heavy water, I ended up on that iteration because it sounded best. Mm. And that's it. That there was no other consideration. It just sounded best.
Yeah, to me. I think it's cool. Do you think there's a limit to how many drives you could make or have in a product line? Obviously, there's some companies out there. I mean, you know, when we were talking to Brian, and you know, we've spoke to the guys at Earthquaker, and you know, they're companies now that have got 40, 50 pedals in their lineup, and when you're sticking to an analog realm, drives are always the ones that people gravitate to in terms of building. Do you think there's a point where you'll say, oh, I've sort of covered drive, as it were?
Yeah, I think you could say that. I mean, what I would say is everything's a balance. So I've told you my passion is furs and drive. Cool. I will also do the flanges, the delays. I've done the compression. We've done a tremolo. We will do other things that will add to the palette of effects pedals, and hopefully in each iteration that, you know, I sound like a salesman here, but I'm trying to make the best of what I can.
Well, absolutely. And you improved on the Fat General, the compressor. You released a second version of that as well.
Yeah, so the Fat General, yeah, it became the V2, and it's, I mean, that's a pedal actually that's interesting, because that's actually based on Dan Coggins. He had a company called Dinosauro, and this was his OTC, his compressor. And we had the conversation. I said, actually, I think it can be improved, and here's what I want to happen. And so we did it. It is improved. It's got lower noise floor, and it's readily available, whereas the other one is now out of production and highly collectible. It's quite funny. So if you want to spend several hundred pounds on a collectible, that's great. Or you could just buy one that's in, you know, readily available, which is an improvement on that. So I don't know. It's up to you. But anyway, the question, you know, have I done drives? I've done up until now. I'm really happy. I've got other stuff to work on that I definitely haven't conquered fuzz in any way, shape or form. I've got loads to do in that realm. But for now, I think boosts, I'm done.
Yeah.
Drives, I've got some interesting things afoot, but I want to do the other things first.
I see.
I want an analog delay. Make it happen. Come on.
Yeah. Do you know what? You and everyone else. Right? And I'm with you. I really am. But here's the problem with that. And I'm going to do it, but I think I'm going to end up doing some sort of two-tier approach to it. I told you about my touchstones. The problem I have is one of my touchstones for analog delay is the Moog MF104M Super Delay.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah,
I own one. They sell for a ridiculous amount of money now. It is, to my mind, one of the best analog delays that has ever been made. Okay? Not to everyone's taste. The Ibanez AD9, amazing.
Oh, the okay. AD9, absolutely. Would find it difficult to top.
Yeah, absolutely. Boss DM2. In fact, the Wazza version's amazing.
Yeah, the Wazza version's outrageous.
Yeah, it is amazing. You know, even the Carbon Copy is an amazing pedal. There are so many good delays. Now, the question is, where do you go in the analog realm to improve on that? Well, I'm not going to tell you because we're working on that. But it's just going to take time. The problem is, delays put me well out of my comfort zone. They absolutely do. And I'm quite happy to say that. But when it comes and when it's ready, it should knock people's socks off.
Oh, that's exciting.
Oh, that sounds good. I want it now. Yeah. This is, I mean, this is, you know, I don't talk about it too much on the podcast because I, you know, do keep some work things separate. But I think it's really interesting, and maybe you feel the same, is when I know things are happening in the future, and I'm like, I want it now, and I'm not even the engineer, do you know? And I think when you've got that passion about your own product, it just flows out into the rest of the world and into the people trying it. And I think now, if you're prototyping stuff going, yeah, it's gonna blow people away, I think you're sort of already on the road to success at that point, because you're so confident in your own product.
You hope so. I mean, the problem is you do get a bit nervous about these things, but it's back to that, am I going down a route of making something just for me, or am I making something that's commercially successful? Ultimately, you know, delays are one of those things. They end up being expensive because of what goes into them. Okay. That instantly makes it harder for people to afford. And actually, when you look at the price to effort ratio, you know, actually, delays are very much skewed compared to a basic boost or something like that. So when you do one, you've got to do it because you really want to do it.
Yeah,
right. It's never going to be the money maker.
Well, I guess a lot of your pedals are, you know, the most expensive one on your line is what, 249?
Yeah, that's right.
On your website. And, you know, I think even Chase Bliss said, you know, look, we're doing the blooper, and it's going to be the most expensive pedal we've made.
And they have a £500 pedal already.
So that's, you know, they've already said, look, it's going to be 500. And I guess you kind of have to build that into your business and go, actually, you know what, if we're doing it the Thorpey way and we're building this analog delay pedal and we're using the parts and that we want to use, and it could be another 100, £200 on top, you know, I guess that's sometimes that can be a difficult decision to make, because you're like, will people spend that much money?
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, it's always a consideration, but I suppose you've just got to put your marker in the sand at some point. You know, why are things expensive? Well, there is a difference between something being expensive and something being good value. You know, just because something's expensive doesn't mean it's not great value. And, you know, the Therme is a great example of that, actually. Chase Bliss. That pedal is expensive, especially in the UK. Okay? But it's incredible. Now, it does things that no other delay pedal does. So guess what? At that point, if that's what sound you want, it's good value.
You're absolutely right. And I guess that's kind of where that kind of comes back to what you were saying about all those great analog delays. If you're going to make one and it's, you know, it's as you say, it's going to take more time to design and create than anything else, and so is going to have that premium price point, you know, by default attached to it. You've then got to think of, well, what is the price of a secondhand Ibanez 89 at the moment, or a DM2W, or a carbon copy, which, you know, it isn't a chunk. And then there are loads of things sort of like on the smaller boutique world, Anasounds do a fantastic version of the carbon copy with the Utopia delay, or Seymour Duncan even with the Vapor Trails, and they're all keeping their prices, you know, relatively low. So how do you make something offer more that makes it, you know, that, as you say, like value for money? That's
just to add on to that, I think there's a lot of, and I know that we've maybe spoke about something similar like this before, I think there's a lot of education to be had, because you've probably seen it. The one thing I see all the time on forums as well now is you put a fuzz out and someone goes, classic example is the JHS 60s range that he did that were a Sweetwater exclusive, and they were £400 and he built them himself, and someone went, that's £20 worth of parts, that's all it needs to cost. God. And then someone's just like, well, all right, build me five then. You know, and I think this is the thing people forget, you know, someone might look at the Fallout Cloud and go, well, I can build a Big Muff clone and I can get the parts for $30, you know, and you just think, You have so much to learn.
I mean, look, you know, I suppose it's as effects pedal makers, it's not our job to educate people on how you know, capitalism works. You know, it's just we can hope for everything to cost 2p, but there is a reality. Yeah. You will get it for 2p, but it will be rubbish.
Oh no, yeah, absolutely. I'm a massive advocate of the fact with everything, especially in the gear world, and I think it applies to everything really in the world. You get what you pay for. Like, and absolutely, you get that with guitars. Generally speaking, I'm sure there are some, you know, there are some naff expensive guitars and some fantastic cheap guitars. But generally speaking, if you're spending more money on something, I do think you're getting a better product. That doesn't mean you have to spend the most amount of money on something, but you should really just, you know, I think you should be happy and accept that when you buy a Squire Affinity Telecaster or an Epiphone Les Paul, the Epiphone Les Paul is not as good as the Gibson Les Paul, but it was the best thing that you could afford at that time, and so it's great.
And do you know what? There is nothing wrong with that. You know, all of these things, let's be honest, unless you make your money from being a musician, if this is your hobby, none of this stuff is necessary to your survival, right? It just isn't. And
please don't tell them that.
No, well, you have to be honest. But here's a score, though. We like these things and we want these things because it adds flavor to our life and makes us happy, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. Now, I will never say to someone who's just starting out, you know, like my son's 11, he's just started playing guitar, is he going to get a pedal board full of my pedals from the off? No, that's ridiculous. Why would he? He's a beginner. What he needs is a guitar and a practice amplifier. He doesn't need the £6,000 loaded pedal board. That's insane. All right? And when he starts doing pedals, yeah, he can work for him. But but you know, my point is, I guess, no matter what your budget, the great thing about the guitar world is there's something for you. And just because it's expensive, that should be an aspirational product, really. That's what you're aiming for, if you can. But if you can't, not to worry. You'll get something really good anyway.
Exactly. And that is exactly why there is a clearance section on the Thorpe FX website where you can get money off of...
I wasn't going there, but anyway, yeah. Well done.
Thanks, no problem. Anyway, that pretty much brings us up to time on this week's episode of the Friday special of Guitar Nerds. So thank you so much, Thorpe, for coming on. I feel like we could probably do another couple of hours of this and we'd still be...
Still many questions.
I'm sorry.
I know. I actually think, you know, we're going to be keeping up this Friday special series throughout September. We'd love to get you back on again in like a couple of months, and we can maybe talk about some sort of new things or just carry on this discussion, because, you know, I think me and Matt have had a really great time, so thank you very much.
My pleasure. Me too. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, listeners, remember you can check out Thorpe FX at thorpeeffects.com, or you can visit like the many retailers that dispense Thorpe gear worldwide, from Andertons in the UK to Thomann in Germany, AMS in the USA, Vintage Guitars in Norway, Pedal Empire in Australia, and loads of others. You can follow Guitar Nerds at Guitar Nerds on all major social platforms. And you can join the discussion on Facebook at facebook.com/groups/Guitar Nerds Forum. We'll be back next week with more of this guitar nerdery. Farewell.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.